B. Collins. Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Monday, December 10th, 2018. A big surprise at the Supreme Court today, where newly appointed Justice Brett Kavanaugh played the role of Anthony Kennedy. And the case was a situation where they were voting on whether to take up an appeal or to deny the appeal and let lower court decisions stand. And the issue was states that determined that they were going to defund Planned Parenthood as punishment for the agency's involvement in abortion and in contraception. The court declined to hear a case which would allow states to terminate Medicaid contracts with Planned Parenthood affiliates who offer health care services to low-income women. Now, there were three votes to hear the case. Clarence Thomas, and I believe Neil Gorsuch, and Sam Alito. Brett Kavanaugh had the opportunity to cast a swing vote. And we know from his Catholic background at Georgetown Prep, where he was chair of the 100 Kegs Club, or whatever it was called, that he has taken staunch positions, aligned with the Roman Catholic Church, against women's reproductive rights. So this is a stunner to your humble host. I expected to be whining and weeping a little bit here, saying that, yeah, the Kavanaugh appointment has paid off for the right wing, but today it did not. And Clarence Thomas, who did not speak, issued a statement. What explains the court's refusal to do its job here? I suspect it has something to do with the fact that some respondents in these cases are named Planned Parenthood. That makes the court's decision particularly troubling, as the question presented has nothing to do with abortion. Well, that's not quite true, Clarence. Because the indirect claims were that the states were justified in cutting or eliminating funding to Planned Parenthood because of the tricky video that was secretly shot and then selectively edited to make it look like Planned Parenthood sold fetuses for profit. And so this is a day where I'll take a little bit of a victory. And, as I say, it comes as quite a surprise. Now, there's no surprise that General John Kelly's had enough of the SS Trump. He wants to jump ship. We're told he's barely been speaking to his boss in recent weeks. And I'm sure he's tired of having his advice routinely ignored, having the policies he set violated repeatedly by Jared Kushner, Ivanka Trump, and others. And so Trump made the announcement, and he didn't even tweet it. He told reporters John Kelly will be leaving. I don't know if I can say retiring, but he's a great guy. John Kelly will be leaving at the end of the year. Now, Trump issued that announcement because he felt he had the replacement locked in. But to his surprise, the chief of staff to VP Mike Pence, said, no, I'm going to go back to Georgia and spend more time with my wife and three young children. Nick Ayers, age 36, sits on a small fortune. I'm not quite sure how he acquired it. But he decided that being Trump's chief of staff probably would not be a good career move. And he can go back into Republican campaign politics, maybe even run for office himself. So I have to say Nick Ayers made the right choice there. And I can't imagine anybody who so desperately needs a job and who wants to work for a bully on a daily basis. And speaking of the vice president, a friend of mine got to screen the new movie Vice about Dick Cheney. I believe it's due on theater screens before Christmas. And that's one I definitely want to see. Apparently well-written and pretty accurate based on the reports I've heard so far. So there's a list. Is it worth it? Chris Christie is on list. Speculation could be the chief of staff. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. Mick Mulvaney, the budget director. I don't know. I'm sure he'll come up with something. And I want to, once again, offer my respect for the newly elected Congresswoman from Long Island, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Because when she heard that John Kelly's leaving the White House, she accused him of cowardice, saying that before he leaves the building, he should apologize to Congresswoman Frederica Wilson. Now, so much bad shit has gone through our news pipeline since that happened. I'll certainly forgive you if you don't remember. But Frederica Wilson was riding in a limo with the widow of a soldier killed in Niger when Trump made what was an attempt at a condolence call. And it was so badly, badly handled that the congresswoman went public and demanded an apology for the family of this fatally killed soldier, fatally wounded. And that has never happened. And so I hope that some pressure will build on John Kelly and that he will ultimately issue a meaningful apology. So on Friday, as I recorded the podcast, we had not yet seen the details of Special Counsel Mueller's filings in the Manafort and Cohen cases. And the Manafort case we can dispense with pretty quickly. The assertion is that after accepting the plea agreement and agreeing to cooperate, that Manafort continued to deceive, lie to the FBI, lie to the investigators, and there's talk that he authorized a $125,000 payment, but the redacted information doesn't explain what that is about. So this is, his fault, and he will pay a price for it. But the most outrageous part of this is we know that Manafort's lawyers were taking information based on these meetings that he had as part of his alleged cooperation, and they were immediately reporting it to Trump's lawyers. And I don't know how that can be considered legal, even under these, defense agreements and those sorts of things. This is highly irregular, and it once again appears to be part of an effort to obstruct justice. Then we go to the Cohen case, and Michael Cohen. There were two different filings, one from the Southern District of New York where they said, hey, this guy didn't enter into a cooperation agreement. He is a serial criminal well before the hush money payments to Karen McDougal and to Stormy Daniels. And we think he should serve significant time. They're talking about 4 to 5 years. Then the Mueller team weighed in and said, well, he's been pretty helpful to us. He didn't execute a formal cooperation agreement, but he told us some good stuff. And so, sentence him for the New York stuff and no additional time for us. Or if you do add time for the Mueller claims, then the sentence can run concurrently, which means that it's not a significant sentence. But behind all this is how much does Michael Cohen know? And did his latest guilty plea, where he admitted to lying to Congress about how long the efforts to cut a deal for a Trump-Moscow hotel continued. It's roughly about 6 months. He had said previously it stopped in January of 16. It continued until May or June. Now, no deal ever materialized, and I consider this to be a lot of speculation. Again, what emerges is corruption, deep and ongoing corruption by Trump and his cronies. But at least from the Mueller filings to date, no clear public evidence of collusion, where there was a back and forth, a mutual agreement to accept Russian support in order to beat Hillary Clinton. And so I await the true evidence of that, and as I've always promised, if that evidence surfaces, I will accept it. But we haven't seen it yet. What we're seeing is more evidence of a ham-handed campaign where they didn't know what George Papadopoulos and Carter Page were doing. And they didn't need Page or Papadopoulos to grease the way for a meeting with Putin if Michael Cohen was already in touch with the top officials in the media organization at the Kremlin. And the fact that nothing happened leaves us with a lot of speculation about attempted collusion, attempted profiteering. And I think it suggests that Trump had no expectation that he was going to win. And he wanted to use this failed run for the presidency to enhance his political and his wealth power as much as he could. And so I was amused when I listened to Rush Limbaugh on my way to the secret studio today. And he was going on and on and on that the hush money paid to McDougal actually paid to the National Enquirer, and the hush money paid to Stormy Daniels' lawyer, that these are just garden variety non-disclosure agreements. Everybody does it. What's the big deal? And he tried to establish, pardon me, I've got a little bit of something in my throat today. He tried to establish that, these are not campaign related. Well, that's just total bullshit. And Limbaugh knows it. These are not ordinary non-disclosure agreements. They were both concluded at the height of the campaign in October of 2016. And they are, and I know this well because I've worked on federally regulated political campaigns. These are what are called in-kind contributions, non-cash. In terms of, Michael Cohen didn't put $130,000 into the Trump campaign. He paid $130,000 to Stormy Daniels' lawyer. And it was part of the effort to get Trump elected without that information being disclosed. So it's very clear. And it's also a clear impeachable offense. And the idea, we know that Trump directly talked to David Pecker at the National Enquirer. For Limbaugh to claim that this is just an ordinary non-disclosure agreement, well, that doesn't pass a fundamental smell test or laugh test. So what did Mueller tell us about Michael Cohen in the filings that were made public and heavily redacted on Friday? Well, Cohen pleaded guilty to lying about the Moscow Project to Congress, saying initially it was terminated in January of 2016, when in fact it occurred much later in the year, roughly in May or June. Now, for the first time in this investigation, Mueller directly stated that Trump was aware of activity during the campaign that Mueller believes is material to his investigation. The activity around Trump Tower Moscow is particularly relevant, the filings say, because it happened at the time when sustained efforts by the Russian government to interfere in the election were taking place. Now, Mueller refers to those, but there is no evidence, so far, of those activities. Secondly, Cohen's lies to Congress, according to Mueller, were a key piece of the effort to derail investigations into Russia, writing that they aimed to set the tone and shape the course of congressional hearings, that Cohen hoped would limit the investigations. And there's also the hint that Cohen was coached, that Cohen told Mueller that the circumstances behind preparations for his congressional testimony, he related that, and that Mueller found that to be useful information. Mueller claims to have evidence that those with Trump connections and those claiming connections to Putin were both interested in arranging a Trump-Putin meeting. Now, there does seem to be significant evidence of this. But was it for the purpose of discussing how Russia was going to meddle in our election, how they had hacked the DNC and had Hillary's emails and were going to feed them to WikiLeaks? There is no evidence of that whatsoever on the record as of this date. So once again, I conclude that what we have so far is corruption, not collusion. And yet I maintain that that is enough to impeach Donald J. Trump and remove him from office. And I fully recognize what it takes to impeach a president. Watergate is where I cut my chops as a young talk show host in Chicago. I remember it vividly. And so when I hear people like Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, even James Comey is recommending against impeachment, thinks it would be divisive. And many people say, well, you simply can't get it through the Senate. You don't have the votes. No, you don't have the votes today. That is very true. But if Gerald Nadler, who's heading up the Judiciary Committee incoming, Democrat from New York, if he were simply to open an impeachment inquiry and announce that they are ready to receive any report that Robert Mueller writes, it would have a huge impact in checking the brazen behavior of this president, if nothing more. And as more information surfaces of what I see as a clear obstruction of justice campaign, I still can't figure out exactly what they were obstructing. Well, if Watergate is any model, over time, some Republicans will decide that their political future is better off supporting impeachment than aligning with an impeachable president. And that's what it takes to build that momentum. And if you don't try, you can never get there. And so to hear Jerry Nadler say, well, these would be impeachable offenses, talking about Cohen's guilty pleas. Buddy hastily added, whether they are important enough to justify an impeachment is a different question. But certainly they'd be impeachable offenses because even though they were committed before the president became president, they were committed in the service of fraudulently obtaining the office. But Nadler said it's too early to say whether Congress would pursue impeachment proceedings. Well, it's this kind of lame leadership that leaves us stuck with a fatally damaged president and weak opposition unwilling to remove him. On the New York Times front page, they said Democrats said this could lead to impeachment, but they're not willing to take the step. It's like, you know, they want some outside force, some miracle intervention that impeaches Trump for them. And now hear this. These are two different reports, one from The Guardian, that Maria Butina, the Russian woman accused of spying for Moscow in the U.S., has indicated that she will plead guilty this week. Now, she attempted to infiltrate the NRA. She asked a question of Trump at a news conference in Las Vegas. Hey, what do you think about lifting sanctions against Russia? So she's been a curious figure since we first learned about her. And what we know is that she forged a deep alliance with the National Rifle Association. And while Mother Jones magazine has gone off the deep end on Russiagate, they put out an interesting joint report with an outfit called The Trace. And The Trace works on the NRA and their gun regulation lobby. They teamed up to investigate the NRA's finances and political activity. The NRA spent $30 million to help elect Trump more than any other independent conservative group. Most of the money went toward TV advertising. They used a media strategy firm to place the media called Red Eagle Media, and documents clearly show that Red Eagle is a subsidiary of a company called American Media and Advocacy. And they have the same chief financial officer, John Farrell. John Farrell signed orders for television advertising on behalf of the Trump campaign and on behalf of the NRA campaign. Now, we don't know if NRA funds that were used for TV ads for Trump came from Russia. But there is significant information that funds were channeled into the NRA from Russian accounts. And this, my friends, could be the real smoking gun, the real nexus of Russian interests and the Trump campaign merged together in a tangible way. This is not some, you know, likes and bots and Facebook ads and all that murky stuff. This shows collusion in spending media money on behalf of Trump's campaign. And in one case, they broke it down with a TV station that was carrying the Virginia Tech East Carolina game. And the TV spots ran on a radio station, a TV station, I think, in Richmond. And they were able to show that in 1 hour, both the NRA and Trump bought ads. When the NRA ran two ads in an hour, the Trump campaign ran one. And in the next hour, when the Trump campaign ran two spots, the NRA ran only one. So this is really powerful. And it seems to me that this is where the attention and the energy should be focused. And it could produce substantiation of claims of collusion between Russian interests laundered through the NRA and funneled into the Trump Campaign Control Center. And after all this talk of the DNC and hacking, the email leaks, the WikiLeaks, to me at this point, that appears to be a sideshow. And I'm really eager to see the main feature here. Every day I pause for a moment to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Great people like Susan Lewis, who feeds the podcast to her formerly conservative husband. Richard Mott just renewed an annual subscription. Paul Karsh and Alice Carlson. They each kick in $5 a month. And here at the holidays, I put out that special appeal. Don't forget Peter B. If you listen on a regular basis and you value what I do, I urge you to kick in $5 a month. And if you've got extra cash, make it 10 or 20. If you want a good deal, take the $50 annual subscription. We'll bonus you with John Dist's new rock and roll CD, American University. I wish you all the best for the holidays. And if you're able to support me, I appreciate it even more. Well, a front pager on the New York Times Sunday really pulled back the curtain on Trump's crown prince, his son-in-law Jared Kushner, and Saudi Arabia's Mohammed bin Salman. And what the Times reports is that Jared was sized up early by Saudi spies. Quote, "The inner circle of the Trump White House is predominantly dealmakers who lack familiarity with political customs and deep institutions." And they support Jared Kushner. So he became the person that they wanted to cultivate, to seduce. And it's quite apparent that they succeeded. He considers himself the way George W. Bush called Bandar, Prince Bandar, his brother. Well, those ties have been revived, renewed, and extended in hope of creating, I guess, a Trump dynasty like the Bushes had. And the unauthorized exchanges without a member of the National Security Council present when Jared contacts Mohammed continued, we're told, after the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi on October the 2nd. And Kushner is described as the strongest defender of the crown prince in the White House. It's quite revealing. I've linked to it. Encourage you to read it when you have an opportunity. On Friday, we mentioned that former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson offered some honest and candid comments about the man he used to work for. I've got the full quote for you today. He was speaking in Houston. "It was challenging for me, coming from the disciplined, highly process-oriented ExxonMobil Corporation, to go to work for a man who is pretty undisciplined, doesn't like to read, doesn't read briefing reports, doesn't like to get into the details of a lot of things, but rather just kind of says, 'Look, this is what I believe.' Trump," he said, "kept pressing for actions beyond his authority. So often the president would say, 'Here's what I want to do, and here's how I want to do it.' And I would have to say to him, 'Mr. President, I understand what you want to do, but I can't do it that way. It violates the law.' Often," he said, "when Trump would get irritated, I'd say, 'Here's what we can do. We can go back to Congress and get this law changed. And if that's what you want to do, there's nothing wrong with that. I'm ready to go up there and fight the fight, if that's what you want to do." Now, these are honest, but he said them, or they were reported, on the day when Mueller was issuing his filings to the courts. And we know that makes Trump nervous. And when Trump gets nervous, he reaches for his phone and he tweets. So he did. Mike Pompeo is doing a great job. I'm very proud of him. His predecessor, Rex Tillerson, didn't have the mental capacity needed. He was dumb as a rock, and I couldn't get rid of him fast enough. He was lazy as hell, Now there's a whole new ballgame. Great spirit at state. Now, that wasn't the other compulsive tweeting target. The only one, I'm sorry. George Conway, who is known as Mr. Kellyanne Conway, has continued to make personal comments on Twitter that put him at odds with his wife in her professional capacity. And so Eric Trump went out of his way to tweet this comment. And he said, of all the ugliness in politics, the utter disrespect George Conway shows toward his wife, her career, her place of work, and everything she's fought so hard to achieve might top them all. They even got Kellyanne to say that I think his tweets, critical of the president, I think it's disrespectful. I think it disrespects his wife. That's the talking point that comes out of Kellyanne Conway and the media team at the White House. And what has George done? Well, he's told the truth. When Trump responded to the, well, Conway responded to the president's praise of Roger Stone, who praised Stone for claiming he would never testify against him. And Conway tweeted, file under 18 U.S.C., the section of the law that pertains to obstruction of justice and witness tampering. And so the effort is to divide the Conways, because George occasionally tweets the truth. Across the pond, Theresa May had a dose of reality over the weekend. She doesn't have the votes to get Brexit through the parliament, so she has postponed the vote indefinitely. She says she's just going to try to wrangle more support, but others talk about a new vote by the public or a Plan B renegotiation. The European Union says no more negotiation, we are done. The issues relate to the status of Northern Ireland and just the fundamental fact that she does not have the votes to pass it. Now, the entire parliament is divided, including the Labour Party, and its leader, Jeremy Corbyn, has been able to avoid taking any specific stands as Theresa May twists in the wind and risks losing control of the government. Now, Corbyn, who has survived anti-Semitic smears in recent months, is either really cagey or he's just trapped because his party is split on Brexit. Corbyn himself is a lifelong critic of the European Union, but he doesn't want to in any way support the Conservative Party's effort to leave the European Union. So his powder is dry, and I would look for a no-confidence vote to try to unseat the Theresa May government. And just the Eurostar ride away in Paris, over 1,000 people were arrested in the yellow vest protests as they continued in Paris and around France this weekend. And I want to make it clear that I have reported to you that the trigger for these protests is the new gas tax that is part of the climate change package under the Paris Accords. But it is really just the straw that broke the proverbial camel's back, and there are long simmering resentments against Macron for not only his autocratic style, but his anti-labor policies since he has become the leader of France. And in Poland, there is a climate conference underway, and the Trump administration sent a U.S. delegation, which played a PowerPoint or a video promoting our unapologetic utilization of coal, oil, and gas. It led to laughter, and then jeers, and then chants of keep it in the ground and shame on you. So we're over there pretending that we have clean coal and that we're all about expanding energy to prop up the world economy. But the people there know better, and they even made the case about the financial risks of failing to address climate change. Global investors managing $32 trillion issued a stark warning to governments at the UN Climate Summit, demanding urgent cuts in carbon emissions and phasing out of all coal burning. Without these, the world faces a financial crash, several times worse than the 2008 crisis. Well, if Trump could hear anything, it would be that. And a new study from the folks at the Climate Action Tracker shows that despite the best intentions of those who signed the Paris Accord, that the Europeans are coming closest to meeting their goals but are falling short. China is highly insufficient, and in Brazil, under new leadership, there are deep questions about whether, well, whether they will exploit the Amazon instead of preserving it. On Friday, I reported to you that in Charlottesville, Virginia, the jury had taken up deliberations in the case of James Fields, the 21-year-old from Ohio who rammed his car into the crowd of counter-protesters and killed Heather Heyer. He was convicted on all counts, and to the credit of the father of Heather Heyer, he has gone public and saying that, well, there's no death penalty being sought in Virginia, but there will be a federal trial later, and I don't relish the thought of him getting the death penalty. I'd rather him get his heart straight and get life in prison. And finally, today is International Human Rights Day. And a man I have deep respect for, and as you know, I got to meet him last year and interview him, the Chinese dissident and artist and activist Ai Weiwei. Well, he has just designed a new flag for Human Rights Day. I don't recall any kind of symbol for human rights, he said. So it was time we gave it one. And he has developed a flag which includes the footprints of barefoot children. That's the image that stuck with him when he traveled the world in 2017, putting together his powerful documentary film, which depicted the refugee camps, 25 of them, scattered around the world. I've linked to Ai Weiwei's statement. It's in The Guardian today, and I encourage you to read it. And when the flag is released, maybe you'll get a hold of one and fly it. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. Please share it all over the dang place. You'll find it on YouTube, and I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.